If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blubbity Blah.
Sending out good vibes.
Good vibes. Utter deep breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
All right, we've got Nick Sprack back with us again to talk about the Cosmic Summit Conference. We're going to do a little wrap-up. Thanks for suggesting this, Nick. It's sure. Good hanging out with you for the weekend.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
That was good.
Maybe a little bit too much fun.
Well, yeah. It is kind of weird being sober because time for bed. And when I got up to the airport, there's people still up. when I was leaving for the airport.
We pulled back into the parking lot from getting cookout at 3:30 and we were looking for you walking through the parking lot. So it's a real thing. But, you know, the tree of life out there in the courtyard is fruitful and it kept a lot of people awake for a long time.
Yeah.
That was Monday night. I was already long gone. I was in the mountains eating steak.
That sounds nice still.
It was quite nice.
Mm-hmm.
Quite nice. I hiked into a little river and did some splashing around in the river, seen some mega flood evidence there. And it wasn't Tennessee. It was still North Carolina, but you could really see where it was where a bunch of water, because the whole river where it's coming down the hill and then it comes down into a nice flat river where it's coming down is all these giant chunks of some sort of rock. I don't know what kind, but it's just giant slabs all piled up that the water's trickling and pooling around and through.
So you went out to Powell's, right?
Yeah. No, not to Powell's. We met at an Airbnb type thing.
Okay, cool.
So then all the water comes crashing. You can see how when there was a bunch of water, you can't really see because there's so much vegetation, you can't really just stand back and see it. But you can see what the sides are made up of. So you can tell that, a shitload of water was coming down there at one time and was just sort of stripping these big rocks because that's what everything's just sort of made up of and just leaving them in a pile down the waterway. Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Randall has said for the longest time, is that the Southeast was flooded based on these torrential rainfalls that came after the meltwater really came through from the ice sheet. So. At first that you're how did all this water, where did it come from? Cause you're looking uphill and there's not a glacier up there, but it dumped up there for sure. You can see that coming all the way down through the Cumberland Plateau, upper, middle and lower all the way down.
I came through the Cumberland Plateau as well. So I got to see that for the first time.
Yeah, it's beautiful. But yeah, like you said, the vegetation makes it very difficult to see. So
makes it pretty hard to see anything. It's just a giant forest, a giant super thick forest.
Yep. November and March is pretty much your best bet to see when things are dead, because they might be snowy if you go a little bit deeper into the winter. But that's when, the March tours is when we did the Cumberland, the two Cumberlands that I was on. So that was nice.
Well, why don't we start with some, what our favorite things were, maybe favorite presentations or favorite things. I mean, because there was some unusual things this year. There was the Coffre press conference with the Italian researchers and the whole underground thing. And there was the vases. So Matt Bell brought 30 of his vases there, the authentic, ancient Egyptian vases. So there's those two
artifacts,
unusual things. And also, before I forget, if people want to go back and watch some of the stuff, I think that our code 3CAMS still works to get $25 off the, you can go in and get all the videos, I think. So, which is normally $75. So I think for $50, you can still get access to all the Dreams.
Sweet.
All the presentations.
Which is, you know, some of it's new stuff. I mean, that's what I did like about this year is I saw, I saw some people I hadn't seen, but it was new material. And I think that's one of the challenges with these big events is how do you keep, like, if you keep having Randall and Robert Shock there, for example, like every year, but it's not new material, then I don't know, people, I think it's probably a challenge to get people back all the time, you know?
Yeah, like how much crazy new shit can you discover in a year, you know, because we come back every year and it's like, well, this year was a good one. A lot of things developed this year. So, you know, it seems like it might be ramping up, you know, like an exponential sort of, novelty is increasing, as Terrence McKenna said, and we're getting more and more complexity as we go. So I think we have a fruitful 2026 to look forward to, I hope.
Yeah, the quickening, as Art Bell called it.
Yeah.
Quickening. Right. And I think, I'm just getting to the point where, like, I just don't want to hear for an hour, like, something that I've heard 10 times before. I'm just at the point where, you know, so I'm kind of like ADHD in that regard now. I mean, if I'm in a conference, I don't want to sit there and listen to, like, the Sphinx water erosion again for the 10th time
right.
in the last 12 years. So, but I did want to mention my favorite was Tim Hogan and the Templar stuff. Like, last year I didn't see any of the Templar stuff. So, cause you kind of have to pick your categories in a way. Mm-hmm. That's the challenge. And I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing that you've got so many speakers on three different stages. Like, would you get just as many people there if you just saw it, like, had one stage going for longer periods, right? Cause they're tough choices. I mean, I wanted to see Ashton Forbes and Bob Greenier talk about new energy and new technology, that kind of stuff. They're both fascinating. But yet I wanted to see the Templar thing because last year I missed it. And then I went home at last year and I was like, I was sort of mildly obsessed, interested in the Templars. I was watching some Templar stuff. So this time I thought, okay, like, I'm going to pay attention to the Templar stuff, but I didn't see Ashton and Bob Greenier. That was a really difficult choice. But Tim Hogan, I mean, I don't know. I think he sounds legit, and it sounds like the Templars and some other of these societies, sort of secret societies, are bringing forward more information. They're in a time of disclosure, and yep. We talked about Scott Walter being sort of fast-tracked into the Templars and how this is sort of part of the reveal, like the season of reveal. And he was talking about alchemy. Tim was going through the whole alchemical process. Going back to the Egyptians, he thinks it comes from Atlantis. It was really interesting. He says it comes all the way back from Atlantis, and they're making mana out of metals. And it was sort of an energy source. It's really, really fascinating with the arcs, the Ark of the Covenant and all that stuff. I mean, did you see all that, Nick?
I saw his presentation I have the program right here. I saw the first one. Let's see. Well, I don't remember exactly when that was, but
yeah, Saturday morning. Yeah, it would have been.
Yeah. So I saw his thing last year. It was, you know, so last year the all day presentation was Haley Ramsey, Scott Walter, and then Tim Hogan, and he just briefly touched on the alchemical part of, he showed the videos of breaking down the gold and converting it into several different stages. But this time he went into a lot more detail about that process specifically. And I actually got his book of the different stages of colors that powder has to go through before it returns to the, before it ends up in its final pure white form. And I guess the different things that each one of those substances can be used for along the way. But yeah, man, one thing that really corroborated what Tim has been saying about the Templars, you know, as truly the seekers of Atlantean history, knowledge, technology, was these pictures of the artifacts they pulled out of the Java Sea. I don't know. Did you get a chance to see those from Megan?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I could pull some of them up, but
yeah, sure. Yeah. You should do that. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this kind of corroborates it. Let me,
those are the pictures you posted in the Telegram.
Yeah. Correct.
The crazy songs and shit.
Yeah, dude. So in particular, along this track, we've got share screen.
And this is Nick's talking about Danny Hillman and his assistant were there. Danny's presentation was about Atlantis being in Sunderland. And it was pretty interesting, actually. Like, there seems to be a lot of underground anomalies. I mean, this is just going to come out. There's so much evidence coming out all over. It's going to be.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's the quickening. And, you know, Atlantis being in Indonesia doesn't really track with Plato, but it still does track with there being multiple globally interconnected societies living in the Ice Age.
Yeah,
especially when you see this. Okay, so can you see that?
Yeah.
All right. This is one of the things pulled out of the Java Sea, and this is the same material that the jewelry was made with that was actually there. All of us physically handled this stuff. There was the ring, the giant necklace, and the Ouroboros armband. But if you notice, I mean
that just looks really Atlantean, doesn't it? Eh?
Right. That's the Templar cross.
Oh, and if you look
closer, I mean, I haven't checked the proportions of this yet, but here's your central island. Here's your next ring. Here's your next ring. And then here's the big ring. And maybe there's another one there too. But this stuff is rough, right? Tons of thoughts on this. I guess the disclaimer to these artifacts is that they are going to need to be verified as authentic before we can really get too excited. However, from my experiential observations of what was actually presented to what was brought that she had back at the table, I've never seen anything like it before. I've handled plenty of metal. I've been to machine shops. I've seen like shitty reproduction artifacts of, you know, woo-woo shit that we love to see, but I've never seen anything like this before. And the claim is that it was made of pure iron nickel meteorite. And
yeah. So how would you verify, like when you said one of the important parts will be to verify all this, but what would you verify? Just the metallic structure, right? I mean, and that maybe it sat in the sea for a long time. I mean, could you verify that? Cause you can't really verify when it was made or how it was made.
Well, a few things. So if you notice on some of these objects, it looks like they are pitted. Yeah. So see these. So to me, what this implies is that there was rust there and it ate away at this metal over time. And then at some point when whoever discovered it, they sandblasted it or cleaned it and tried to restore it, which is a no-no. But again, we're talking, you know, some fishermen in the Java Sea pulled this stuff up, I guess, pretty recently. And based on the room, so I don't know what this room is. I haven't even looked in depth at the pictures, but there's all kinds of shit in here, right? You've got everything from Dragon Ball Z figurines to Atlantean war weapons of war. And this is Danny holding all of these things, but you know, there's fucking Goku down there. So obviously this is like some sort of amateur setup. If we wanted to verify it, though, we would need to hit it with an XRF gun and get a composition, take a like spectroscopic analysis of what this stuff is to determine if it is truly iron meteorite. But I've never seen, I've seen plenty of iron. I've never seen anything quite like this with its roughness, with its particular texture. And the thing that stood out the most to me, and unfortunately I fucking forgot to take a picture, but the ring.
I got a picture of it. Or the armband or the ring? I don't think I got a picture of the ring.
So, yeah, I got a picture. Somebody sent me a picture of the armband, but the ring is the big one because it shows the interior cross-section of this material. So, look at that helmet or crown, right? So this thing is two times the diameter of his head. It's huge. So, you know, at first you think that, let's see if I can stop sharing real quick. Am I still?
Yeah, you stopped sharing, yeah.
Okay. So at first at first glance, this stuff looks like, it looks fake almost, but coupling these pictures with what was actually there, and being told it's made of the same material. I mean, like I said, I've never seen anything quite like it. So the ring, first of all, so my finger is not very thick, right? It's not saying much to claim what I'm about to say, but the interior diameter of this ring was at least three times the diameter of my finger. Okay. The necklace was not comfortable to wear. You just saw how big that helmet was. You saw how big those swords were, the ones that he was carrying with two hands. Those are designed as one-handed weapons, not two-handed weapons. A two-handed weapon is going to be longer, right? Like a claymore, but those are still relatively short, but he had to carry them with two hands. So to me, these are designed to be carried by somebody that can lug around something that big with a single hand, single arm, dual wielded, or with a shield, right? So the ring, though, the cross section of this thing, I mean, I tried to describe it the best I can. It was fibrous, spongy, kind of porous. Do you remember seeing it like that?
I don't remember seeing the ring at all. I just saw the Ouroboros and the box.
Okay. So I have a picture of the Ouroboros here. I say Ouroboros. Is that?
I've always said Ouroboros. Probably
doesn't really matter.
Yeah. It's probably like, you know, aluminum kind of thing.
Right.
Aluminium is what is the dude English with claws on his hands, yeah. Isn't it?
With the what?
Wolverine or whatever.
Adamantium.
No, unobtainium is from the green guy one.
Yeah,
Green Lantern. Well,
no, Avatar.
Oh, right.
Can you zoom in on that at all? Or
I can try. Let's see. Oh yeah, here we go.
So that's terrible. Pretty heavy. That would fit around. Okay. Fit around your wrist. It's too big to fit on your wrist. It's bigger than a bracelet. So
yeah, my wrist fit probably. It's probably, again, three times the size of my wrist. And again, that's not saying much. I'm not a thick dude, but this was, you know, you can extrapolate what it would mean. So the ring, though, the notes that I had here. Interior opening at least three times the width of a normal human finger. The top section was broken, revealing a spongy, fibrous, metallic cross-section resembling petrified wood or magnetic filament structures. So again, it's hard to, I've never seen anything like this before, so I don't really know how to describe it. But it was heavy and it was magnetic. So it seems to be like verifiably iron meteorite. And the other thing is I pulled up a picture of King Tut's dagger. So King Tut's dagger is made of an iron nickel meteorite. It's polished, so it's a lot smoother, but it has the same exact hue to it. It's like this gray gunmetal color. Huh. So, you know, if this stuff is real, I think it was probably meant for a giant to be wearing it.
Here's the map that you got me going on here. Now I'm stuck with it, but I mean, because he's in Indonesia, so that's this whole area here, right?
Yep.
which is fascinating in this map, right? Here's the East Pacific Rise. There's like Easter Island and French Polynesia. And then look at this, how this was all like, it looks like a huge plateau over here, you know?
Yeah.
Yep. Even connecting Australia, like imagine how close you were across the
Timor. Yeah. Sea. Why would you, they bring up, and I agree that at some point, probably 60,000 years ago, people made it from Southeast Asia to Australia. That's how, you know, that's the alternative kind of heretical view about seafaring travel, is that 60,000 years ago, people went from Southeast Asia to Australia. But 60,000 years ago, sea levels would have been way different. They could have just walked, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, look at this. This is only 38 meters here, right here, where the cursor is.
Yeah.
So 150 feet deep, right? So that would have all, like, if we look at that 400 foot increase after the last ice age, that would all be connected there.
Yep, absolutely.
So, and you said the Java Sea is where they're finding this stuff?
Yep, right there.
And Megan's trying to do like a fundraiser. We're going to have her and Danny on probably, because they want to try and like raise some money to do a whole bunch of scans. They're setting up a bunch of scans to do. Because that would be like a, you could use a metal detector to find a lot of this iron, you'd think, okay?
Totally. I mean, it's, you know, it's super magnetic. I mean, it was... And it, you know, it had an energy to it too. I'm not great with those things, but even I could sense that it was special. So yeah, it would be easily detectable with a magnetometer being dragged behind a boat. That's what that stuff is for. And it's at, like I said, 38 meters. That's what, 80 feet. That's not deep at all. That's about the same depth as the North Sea. And there's some weird things being found up there too.
Let's go take a look over there.
North Sea.
Right there.
Yeah, so there's another one. You're going to have some Viking.
It's exactly the same depth right there. It's a meter off. Yeah.
So Hyperboreans might be all over there.
Holy.
And and during the Ice Age, that would have had rivers all through it. Modern day England and Scotland would be the mountains. You wouldn't even want to be living up there because it would be too cold. So people would have been living in those lowlands where all the water drained, where the land was fertile. And obviously now, but that's where you're going to find the stuff.
Wow. I didn't realize it was so shallow there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's pretty deep in the Baltic Sea there, but if you go over to the North Sea, 60 meters, huh?
Yep.
That's interesting. So what did you think about, okay, so we'll talk about Danny. I mean, did you see Danny Hillman's presentation? What did you think about that?
I thought it was really well done. And I got his presentation, so I'm going to dig into it some more and just to like become more fluent in it.
Yeah.
You know, we learned quite a bit from Ancient Apocalypse and, you know, just what you can showcase in a 10-minute, 15-minute segment on a Netflix show. That was a lot of information, and Graham has talked about it many times, and I think they've had many press releases. But the way that he presented it was in a way that near the end of it, he goes into all of the other stuff. Because when we think Indonesia, when people in our circle think Indonesia, we pretty much just think Gunung Padang, right?
Totally.
But, oh my goodness, there's a lot more. I mean, it's basically the same thing as the Amazon and as Mexico, the jungles of Mexico, finding all of these structures just all over the place, thousands of them. And the ones that he brought up apparently seemed to be similar to Gunung Padang. There's, I forget the names, take me years to remember the names, but also built into the side of mountains, similarly to Gunung Padang, layered with several iterations of construction. So, I'm really excited to help those guys get the funding for that too. I walked up to the table at one point, and there was a guy there talking to him, and I was like, "Hey, y'all, if you donate to the fund, I'll match it right now." And it worked. So
nice.
I still got to figure out a way to pay him though, because I didn't have cash. Will you move, Kat? Jeez.
I think I didn't see a ton of presentations. My favorite thing was the vases, though. I did see the movie.
Yeah, they were really cool.
The vases were the highlight for sure. It was very cool to see all those and get to play around with them a little bit. And also, I mean, I like shock stuff, that sun stuff and the electricity stuff. I mean, because I'm not convinced about the comet thing. I mean, me and George talked about it on the other show. It just seems like it's still a lot of water. It's so much water to try and create instantaneously that, even like a comet to me, it's like blowing apart chunks of ice in a lot of ways, more than just melting it. I feel like the water's either getting washed around or I feel like the oceans maybe have more to play with it. Like that picture you got there behind you, there on top of the mountain, and the ocean is coming. Which is kind of what the Enoch and that stuff sort of alludes to, too, that they're hiding out on a mountain. I mean, who do we have? Was it you we had on the show that was talking about the... No, we had someone else in the show that was saying that was the mountains down in South America, right? Graham, where Enoch went and was hanging out?
Yeah, not me.
Yeah, somebody mentioned it, I think. Was it in like where Machu Picchu was and all that?
They were up in those mountains waiting for the cataclysm. And when you showed me that painting behind you, that's what made me think.
Right. Well, they did that. I mean, that is the cloud city that was as a retreat to be saved from the waters. You know, they went up there. And it, you know, well, like we see all the time, there's these parallels in all these stories. But you're right. It is. It's really hard to differentiate between comet and solar outburst, mainly because if it was a barrage of comets, there would be airbursts. And discerning between the pressure and heat plasma wave of an airburst and just a plasma wave from the sun, I can't imagine that's going to be too easy to do. So it's going to look virtually identical. But, you know, we've got pretty clear evidence that there were some major celestial alignments. In fact, last night we were just going over it with Ed Nightingale on some of his Giza template stuff. And he pulled up a slide of going back in time in Stellarium, looking at it. Very important points in history, specifically 13,800 years ago, this 14,000-ish year ago event, this big solar event that I think they've proven actually happened with the tree ring study that came out a couple of months ago. When you look at that point in time from the perspective of the Sphinx on the galactic alignment, which is December 21st, 2012, you can see this major alignment that occurred where the sun and the galactic center and several other stars are all aligned. And when you have that alignment with all these stars, it's the work of, what's his name? John... Basically, it's the Birkeland currents, right? The Birkeland currents of the stars and the sun are compounding on each other, and those currents cause each star in that line to have, you know, probably more dangerous outcomes for the planets around them.
John Brandenburg? Yeah.
They proved it. So there was a guy that was hired by the Army. He worked for RCA. Back in the, I'm trying to find our damn Telegram group here. Here we go. So John Nelson, he was an RCA electrical engineer post-World War II era who studied disruptions in shortwave radio communications He discovered that solar activity alone, like sunspots, didn't fully explain radio blackouts. By analyzing years of radio logs, he found a strong correlation between planetary alignments and geomagnetic storms that interfered with high-frequency radio signals. So he found that certain planetary angles, 0 degrees, 90 degrees, 120, 180, between planets like Jupiter, Saturn, Venus, and Mercury often preceded radio disturbances. So when these alignments occurred, it caused the sun to be more active. And he was 90% accurate in predicting radio blackouts. Of course, when he published this stuff and when he told the army, he's like, hey, this is what's going on. They were like, okay, yeah, we'll keep that in mind. Definitely, because he was 90% accurate. Yeah, that's real science. But when he went public with it, it was too close to astrology. So he became, a quack. So if you just extrapolate that to Birkeland currents with stars, it's the same thing. So that's what I think happened at the 14,000 year event. I mean, that's pretty well confirmed now, especially in, Shock's world. But I think the other end, so meltwater pulse 1A, solar. 1B, something different.
Well, that kind of makes sense that there was that time in between all those where people were creating these hideouts or these caves or these measurement devices. Like they started measuring, maybe it was after that first cataclysm that you're talking about. And then there's still a couple thousand years in there where people started to measure celestial movements and the solar, the equinoxes, trying to figure out like, how is this going to happen again? Like we have to measure it. And then maybe, creating these megalithic hiding places or whatever. It's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it would make sense that we only find impact proxies at the 11,600 year mark. We don't find them at the 14,000 year mark. So it's like, well, kind of tracks,
Yeah, maybe so, there's multiple cycles and multiple cataclysms happening.
There's all these. The temperature drop was only at the end of it.
No, the drop was at the beginning and the warming was at the end, right?
Yeah, but then there's another little drop there that alludes to something in the atmosphere blocking out the sun.
Right. Yeah, so just like the Atlantis debate, the Younger Dryas cause debate, I think we can probably say both or all of the above because, if there's an impact, it's going to cause volcanic tectonic movement. It's going to cause earthquakes and volcanoes and all this crazy shit to happen. If there's a solar event, it's probably going to cause that as well. Because not only do you have a plasma discharge hitting the Earth, but that plasma is charged with electromagnetic energy. It's not just a heat wave. It's carrying virtually the same amount of energy probably that a comet's going to have or an asteroid's going to have, just in a different form. So we can like stop yelling at each other over some things and just work together. It'd be nice. I don't think there's a huge debate that's like vicious or anything. It's just pooling resources, I think, would be same team.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's still a debate on Atlantis and the archaeologists are still holding on to their paradigm. They're as tight as they can. I mean, after our Atlantis debate there, that one archaeologist came up and, was trying to explain why we're all wrong and how the archaeology works. Meanwhile, there's some people calling it a pseudoscience, like on the panel, I think. I mean, there seems to be a lot of people fed up with archaeology as a science, and you can understand why. I mean, they're just avoiding the big questions. They seem to be doing whatever they can to maintain their narrative, and they're avoiding the big questions, which to me is there's still a ton of evidence out there that needs explanation. All the granite work needs explanation. I don't think there's any real solid explanation for how they're building the Cyclopean walls, the vases, the scoop marks, the half quarried massive works like from the Brothers of the Serpents unfinished. I mean, that's just needs to be answered.
And why did they just stop dead in their tracks? What happened?
Yeah. I think there's something there that's common to everything. And I think it has to do with like I mean, it's funny because people are like, well, who would you ask if you had all the money in the world? What would you do? Who would you ask? And I'm like, well, two of the guys are here. Like, I'd ask Tim Hogan and Bob Greener. I mean,
yeah,
those two guys, yeah. I think what they're working on is a sort of combined, has to do with, I think it's an alchemical thing. It's alchemy. It's part of ancient alchemy. I mean, that whole thing about the Shamir being a magic diamond, right? It's really interesting to me. Mm. That's what they describe.
Yeah, Bob definitely is right onto that alchemical track, but more like modern alchemy.
Exactly. You know? And then Tim's got the ancient alchemy. So
yeah. Yeah, it's very cool. And it's like we can agree when we're going past and future, past to present and future, and they all link together. That's a signal, right? That something you're on the right path.
Yeah.
For sure. So
Did you get to see Bob and Ashton? Did anybody see Bob and Ashton?
Not together. I saw Bob's first presentation.
Oh, you did? Was that
good? Yeah, it was great. I mean, so much of it was fucking 10,000 feet above my head. But I was started watching it again today because I was trying to find, you know, he brought up this interview with Andrea Piharic, who was a he was a doctor. He was a kind of alternate energy physicist, but he was like pretty well connected. I think he's who got a couple of really prominent Russian scientists over to the United States during World War II. But this interview he's giving, and it's been posted before, I've seen it before, but he's sitting there in front of a chalkboard and he's talking about, you know, before I really speak on it, I should probably just refresh what he showed at the presentation. But essentially the gist, and this ties into your how was the granite shaped, if I recall correctly, there was an experiment somewhere, maybe it was Los Alamos, again I need to be checked on it, but they had combined like three Tesla coils in this lab space and they turned them on and charged this area with like a million amps, and it was not harmful to people. But what it did to an aluminum wrench that was in the room was it made it start glowing white hot.
That's Nick banging on his desk.
Oh
no, sorry, that's footsteps upstairs, sorry. This wrench starts glowing white hot, but they pick it up. It's not hot actually. It just is in an excited state, molecular state, but it's not actually burning them. And when they put it back down and turn off the machine, there's a thumbprint, a fingerprint left in the wrench. So they soften this metal. So if the ancients were using some kind of high energy device, which it appears they might have been, you know, with the pyramids, if they were able to somehow direct that energy with, you know, the scepter and Ankh or obelisks around the world or whatever it is, and they were able to target certain areas with this electrical field, right? The stuff that fucking Tesla was looking into, you know, he was researching the pyramids, right? They were able to target that, they could conceivably shape granite with their hands and not be too not be too crazy about it. And it was causing stuff to levitate too. So boom, there you go. You've got a way to levitate things. So like I said, Bob and Tim's stuff is like, I mean, it's like this. It's just past and present.
Piharic is the one that Marty always talks about from that occult sort of pre-CIA, modern UFO. So kind of like intelligence agencies, like the government playing around with making contact. Piharic was involved in all that. He's the one. Marty always talks about Piharic as one of the main characters in all his podcasts and writings.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty instrumental figure, it seems.
How'd you guys like the movie? Atlantico or whatever.
Atlantica.
It was great. Yeah, that, I mean, that's another whole can of worms. Want to dive in?
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, I thought it was good. What?
What kind of can of worms?
A 12,000-year-old can of worms.
Oh. So you guys, yeah, you go first, Graham.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just want to make a comment. Ian was saying very similar to the Hutchinson effect, and I was going to agree. That's
yes.
That's what it's like, melting metals or, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he brought that up too, John Hutchinson, I believe. Yeah.
You're supposed to have him on the show, but it never happened.
That would be cool.
Yeah. So the Atlanta. So I interrupted you. We were talking about Atlantica. What did I think?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I like the. It was a little little documentary-ish. You know, it was very, fluffy as like professionally made. So it comes across as, how do I say it? over the top in some ways, but I do like how it ended, with them finding stuff under the water. I mean, that's really pretty fascinating, whether it's the capital city or not. I don't know. But I mean, I meant to ask him how they found that location, because they said they just found it. It sounded like they found it by accident. But I thought when I saw the screener of it, which wasn't a full documentary, that they had maybe located it through the satellite stuff. But it's just fascinating.
Buddy found it on Google Earth. That was his sort of role. The dude, the wizard looking dude, found it.
Was Tim Akers?
Yeah.
That was his name.
That was my takeaway too. It's that he found it, and that's that, or he found the evidence of it on the satellite.
So, okay. So he was looking at aerial photography, whether it was Google Earth or whatever, I don't know, but he saw those Roman fishing corrals at low tide, and I guess he wrote about that, and at some point people started going out there and checking it out, and then they were like, well, what if this extends deeper into the ocean? And so they went and scuba dived, and sure enough, there's a bunch more stuff. 5 kilometers out is how far they went to find the proximal limit of this ring city thing, walled structure, whatever it was. So they go scuba dive, they see all these walls and these smaller walls and then the big wall that's like 3 meters thick or whatever, and then they scanned it, and when the scan came, I mean, that's when it all was like the real confirmation. I mean, to me, if you find something 5 kilometers off the coast that is 70 feet beneath the sea, it couldn't really be anything else but a pre-ice age, an ice age civilization, because that was the last time that the water was that low.
Yeah.
Well, it gets weird in that area, though, because Doggerland wasn't that long ago, was it?
Well, that's Doggerland, though, not the Atlantic.
Well, how deep is Doggerland?
There was a big flood in Doggerland up north there. There was a big flood that was like 1500 BC or something like that, almost where Archaic says the big flood was. But like Doggerland apparently hasn't been covered for as long as the rest of it from the Younger Dryas. It was a separate event, apparently.
So how far is this from Doggerland, though? It's just around that corner, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. If I scroll up here, it's probably...
Because to me, Doggerland has to be global, doesn't it? Yeah. How do you just rise the ocean a couple hundred feet right there?
No, because it was a melt from up here, apparently. It was a flood.
Yeah, but it still all ends up in the ocean. So it still levels at the end, right? So you could still have catastrophic water coming through Doggerland, but then once it hits the Atlantic, now it levels off again.
Yeah, it should equalize relatively. I mean, Earth is a geoid, so it's not the same gravitational force. So you're going to have kind of a, like this effect.
Yeah, but still somewhat. You know, you're not going to have part of the ocean right that's 200 feet higher than the other part. It just can't work.
I guess I wasn't aware of this being 1500 BC. I mean, are you saying that the whole North Sea is only
Let me check. Yeah. Wait. Let me check.
Yeah.
3,500 years old.
Yeah. Well, at least this English channel, this part here.
You know? Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't know about that whole North Sea, but I mean, I think that, this dog, whatever would be considered Doggerland, which I think is.
I thought that was the whole damn thing.
Well, maybe it is. Maybe it's all this is Doggerland. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. See what Darren's assistant says on here.
What are you using?
But I mean, what's fascinating is this is where he's saying, like, they think it is, right? This is where it is off the coast right here. Basically, 5 kilometers is not very far off that coast.
Yep.
And that's 60. So it's really like it'd be tied in on that, in that coast somewhere. But I mean, when you really zoom out a little bit here, I mean, you're already island hopping to the Azores right there, you know? I mean, it's right, Azores is right across from there. So,
yep.
6,000 BC.
6,000 BC. Interesting.
BCE.
Okay.
So 4,000.
So not before Christ, but before the Common Era.
Yeah, is that what BCE is? So that's right now.
Yeah. Before Christ. They just don't like to say Christ because they hate Christianity.
It's still 6,000 years. So it's 8,000 years ago?
8,000 years ago. Yeah. I was just making a stupid joke.
Well, maybe I'm wrong then. Maybe that's completely wrong. I always thought it was a different event.
Well, it's still 4,000. Well,
it still would have been,
But so before 6,500, Doggerland was a rich Mesolithic environment. Home to hunter-gatherers, it featured rivers, lakes, and lush plains supporting a wild range of wildlife. Around 6,500 BC, rising sea levels from post-Ice Age glacial melt began shrinking the landmass significantly. Circa 6,200 BC, the Storegga Slide triggered a massive tsunami which likely devastated the remaining coastal areas of Doggerland. This event may have marked the near total submergence of the area. By approximately 6,000 BC, most of Doggerland was underwater.
There's Dogger Bank right there.
Got it.
There's Devil's Hole right there.
So how deep's the water there?
Shallow as fuck.
I wonder if those are little elevation markers, that 106 there.
Does it
90 meters. So Dogger Bank is... 29 meters. Wow.
Well, hang on. Okay. I have something that does not track with that. Do you know about manganese nodules? Have you guys heard about this stuff?
I don't think so.
No. How deep? And it was 70. So it's 29 meters there, and it's 70 feet where Buddy found those circles. So those could have been submerged at the same time. Another 100 feet came later. Seems crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know enough about
this. It seems crazy that it took that long too. If it took 500 years, you could already have like people trying to rebuild stuff and they're like, God damn, the water just don't stop coming.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right. And they're worried about it, like worried about future cataclysms, right? I mean, and that would
And they would have fled uphill. They would have gone and started building castles in the mountains and all that stuff. So, I mean, yeah, that kind of makes sense. But with the manganese nodules thing, okay, so out in the Pacific, there's this massive swath of ocean. It's fucking huge, where all these countries and corporations, including like Eric Prince, had a venture to try to mine these things. Basically, what they are is they're like apple-sized conglomerations of precious metals that have slowly accumulated over like the millions and millions and millions of years. And people are trying to go down there and suck them up with these big vacuum cleaners, basically. And it's this whole thing that's like a geopolitical nightmare. And I mean, there's trillions of these things, or billions at least. There's a book, I don't know the name of it, but apparently people have been harvesting manganese nodules in the North Sea as well. And where I'm not sure if this makes sense or not is the story that the book is about is that the manganese nodules was actually a cover story. and it was a CIA operation to do something else. I don't remember exactly what they were really doing. But if it takes millions of years to create manganese nodules, then they couldn't, then in the North Sea, then the North Sea couldn't have been 8,000 years old. It would have to be much older. So I don't know. That was just a little connection that I made right there. But yeah, the manganese nodules thing is weird. So I'm not saying that I think Doggerland is millions of years submerged, but that's where that CIA cover up kind of doesn't really follow. It's kind of it takes longer than that for those things to accumulate together.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, Atlantis.
How deep's the North Sea? But there's probably parts of the North Sea that are deeper than where Doggerland was too.
Yeah, it's 120 meters. Right near Norway, there's a trench there. There's a Norway trench, which is 265 meters.
I think if you go to the European bathymetric viewer, you can see a more precise, higher resolution, where the difference between 40 and 120 is more accentuated with the color scheme. But it's like it's anywhere from, you know, 0 to 120 meters. Yeah. A friend of mine who's the marine geophysicist that was interested in helping us with the Azores stuff, he's been up in his last project was up in the North Sea, scanning for unexploded ordnance and selling data for telecom distribution construction down there. So he was telling me all this stuff about the manganese and the depths and what they find, and it looks smooth on that view, but it's actually quite, you know, vertically variable, I guess.
To see under 40 meters or under, you know, 50 meters and just to see that everywhere would be great. Yeah.
Right. Right.
So what were you saying about Atlantis?
Well, do you think he found Atlantis? I mean, he seems to think he found Atlantis. Do you think he found Atlantis? I talked to Randall about it after, and his major hangup was that it's not an island. So maybe it's an outcropping or an outpost, but the capital city was said to be an island over and over and over.
Yep. Yes. I agree with that, but I also agree that they found Atlantis. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Atlantis was an empire, okay, that had many island and otherwise impressive colonies around the Mediterranean, around Egypt, around the Atlantic, all the way probably down in South America and even maybe North America. And I talked to Michael afterwards as well, and he basically, I mean, I think we're on the same page. He believes that they found Atlantis, broadly speaking, but there's way more to be discovered. Whether it's the true capital city or not, I think that's probably a no.
Well, I was thinking also that because Plato described that circular city, I mean, that could have been a common architectural design of cities back then, yep, too. I mean, that could have been something they just were doing.
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, we're all into this sacred geometry, right, where you build your cities to be a manifestation of the stars on Earth, as above, so below. So they're not just going to, if the Atlantean design worked for, you know, 20 something thousand years, going back to Zeptepi, right, all the way up until the Younger Dryas, then they're going to try to replicate that with as many of their colonies as they possibly can. And even today, our cities don't really work. I wouldn't argue that, but we still replicate the same thing over and fucking over again.
Oh yeah. Northwest, so, first street, second street, third street. I mean, it's all right, over the place.
Right. Yeah. You do what you know, right? And it's hard to break away from that change. And I think, you know, they were doing the same thing, and that's why you're going to end up finding, you know, who's the team down in Cuba that has, or in the Caribbeans that has found this seemingly ringed structure down there in the islands. You've got that one. You've got the Recot structure. whether that's natural or not, I think that's more natural, but perhaps, yeah, they had a colony there as well, because they seem to control a lot of Africa at the same time as the Greeks and the Athenians were kind of operating kind of in that boundary, right? So, I would like to see people sort of open their eyes a little bit more to the broader possibility of Atlantis being in multiple places, because they were, right? If they were an empire, they were a globally connected civilization. They're not going to have just one location. So, as far as the capital city, I mean, yeah, my money is still on Azores, because it just fits every single one. It fits all of the points. There's not a single one other than not having found elephants there. I'm pretty sure that's the only one that it doesn't like check the box.
You can find elephants in Calgary, Alberta right now. So during the current empire.
What? Because it's a circus?
Because it's, well, when the circus is here or just at the zoo, there's a bunch of elephants. So if you had a kingdom that had an affinity for elephants, it wouldn't be hard to get them.
Yeah. You just, you transplant them, right?
Well, we should probably talk about the SARS scanning and the whole presentation from them. What did you guys think of that?
It was great.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. It was neat to see it compared against all the other structures and stuff like that. I did miss the press release, so I don't know what they had to follow up with. I didn't catch that or hear anything about it, so it couldn't have been that phenomenal. But the presentation itself, I thought, was good.
Yeah, definitely should have been, that context should have been there out there to begin with, just for
right.
Once it got viral, it's like, hey, we've done all this on these other spots. This is how it works. Right. This is what we see for this location that we know there's down there. And then, you know, maybe people would sort of buy it a little bit more. My only difficulty with it is the interpretation from the scans to the architectural drawings or the 3D models that they've done.
They need to do a blind test now where someone goes in where they don't know what's under someplace. And they scan and say what they think's under there. And then, you know, someplace where the plans aren't publicly available.
Yeah, well.
Maybe one of our listeners has a bunker, a secret bunker we can scan.
I don't know if they're a listener, but I know that they were also at the summit. And they have a location that they would like scanned that they've been looking for a long time. You know, the Templars have apparently had these vaults. Right, where the arcs are stored, and I don't think they know where all of them are, because it's been fucking, you know, 700 years or whatever since anybody's been there. But apparently the question was asked to the Italian team, hey, could you guys blast a couple of microwave pulses over in this vicinity and let us know what you find? So that question was asked. I did hear that from some people. And another interesting thing was, do you remember the fella's name that wrote all the books on Pilot Mountain and had the table set up over there? I remember his son's name, Caleb, but I never actually met the author. I want to say his name was Jim or James, but shout out to that guy. Filippo Biondi apparently approached him at some point and told him, was like, hey, the next time that you guys are anticipating a big rain over top of Pilot Mountain, let me know, give us a call, and we'll make sure we pull the data from, we'll try to, I guess they can position the satellite over top of any place they want. So the next time it rains, call me, whatever, and we'll pull SAR data from Pilot Mountain to determine if there actually is, as the legend says, an ancient city beneath Pilot Mountain. So the rain would be the amplifier of the microphone, right? So the pattering of the rain on the ground causing all these vibrations that will go for quite a long ways through the surface, that would be the best way to get the most accurate data, apparently.
When's it supposed to rain in Egypt again?
God.
So the highlight for me had to be the fake baby festival next door. I mean, you walk in, you don't know what is going on, and there's ladies with fake babies.
They look real. They look
some real. Very lifelike, some not so much. Some are being, fake breastfed, and there's strollers all over the place. I mean,
not it just really, you.
Multi-thousand-dollar strollers. Yeah.
Hundreds of fake babies.
Did you see the monkey babies?
Those were pretty freaky.
Monkey babies were weird. The Yoda baby, that was a good one. There was an Avatar baby that had a fucking tail thing coming off of his butt. That was weird.
I heard there was a dragon baby, but I didn't see it. But I mean, most of them are human looking, very real. Like,
yeah.
But it wasn't just a few. I mean, this was like hundreds and hundreds. It was probably one of the biggest doll conferences, I would assume, right? Wasn't it?
Unsettling. World of Dolls, I think it was called.
Something like that. It was very unsettling.
Yeah, no, it was, especially if anybody out there was under the influence of some freaky deaky substances, and that definitely occurred. That's one of those things that would happen when you're tripping, for sure.
Imagine that. Oh yeah, that we would have lost it. Tripping and we saw that. But they were actually pretty open to it, though. Like, they'd let you take pictures, and they were answering questions. I mean, they were pretty proud of it. They weren't like ashamed.
Yeah, no, I was. It was nice to see that they're like confidently, like they're like, yeah, it's kind of weird. We get it, but that's what we like. And if you think it's weird, then that's your opinion, and you can fuck off.
Made us feel more normal.
Yeah, it did. Totally did. I definitely went in there expecting to be the weirdest people. That joke was made many times. But, I got several of their names, the babies' names. I think one of them was named I got an Alex, and there was a Ladasha name, you know, like a Sharquisha or something like that. It was weird. Like, anytime if you were staying in Tower One and you had to walk across the lobby over into their area, it was like, oh fuck, here we go.
I was in Tower One. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I suppose we better wrap up. We got a meeting with Brad about events to get to, but favorite thing, best takeaway. What's the one presentation that's worth paying for $50? I mean, that's not too bad. You get them all, but what's the one main one? You know, yours was Graham's was whose again?
Well, I mean, Ben, we didn't even talk about Ben's. I mean, Ben from Uncharted X was new material. Like, he's been wanting to do this one for a while. So I'm pretty sure that the Cosmic Summit, like, he was probably right before Randall, I think, right? So the second to last speaker. Yeah. And he made this whole presentation around the labyrinth at Saqqara. Yeah. Was it Saqqara? Labyrinth at Saqqara? Or no, what's the other? It's not Saqqara. It's
it's in the area, but it is the place where they always said that the labyrinth would be.
Yeah. Anyways, and it was great. I mean, he went through a lot of the history of it and the labyrinths and the scans, and it's fascinating. And then Tim mentioned Tim Hogan, the Grandmaster Templar, that he thinks that, and Darren and I, we talked about this when we were in Egypt, that the whole Giza plateau has got underground sort of cities and tunnels and stuff. Cause you can go down so far anyways, between, I think, underneath all the pyramids. But he says, Tim said it goes all the way to, why can't I remember the name of the town?
From Luxor?
No, it's not. Is it where the Serapeum is? Anyways, Tim says it's all underground. Hawara. Thank you, Ian. Yes, Hawara. It goes all the way from Hawara to the Giza Plateau. Like, it's all underground, which is pretty interesting. And he says he's been down there. Like, that's where. And see, I don't think they made the connection that Tim had mentioned that there was some ancient secret technology down there. And Ben showed on his scan this massive,
this metal thing.
Metal thing.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know if they know that each other are talking about what could be the exact same thing down there.
They have to. They have to have been in contact, at least at the, I don't know.
Had to. You'd be surprised.
What yeah. I mean, I don't think you can get access to the Atlantica premiere with the live stream, but, God, I don't know. I'd have to, it's a close call between Coffrey Project and Gunam Padam for sure. If it weren't for the artifacts that were actually brought to the summit from Indonesia, I would probably say the Coffrey Project, but because of these artifacts were present for people to physically handle, that connect so many other dots across all of the mythos of pre-diluvian studies, you know, I would say Gunam Padang. Yeah, Danny Hellman's presentation there. With an honorable mention of Matt Beal and bringing all these faces and allowing people to handle them. I mean, these things are, it's the same, like, just mesmerizement, captivation of the precision that is that went into building these things and the geometries encoded into them, just like the pyramids. I mean, all the stuff that we're doing with Ed right now, it's the same thing on a micro level that's being encoded into these small bases versus what's encoded into the pyramids versus what's encoded into the stars versus what's encoded into our bodies. It's turtles all the way down.
I mean, Praveen Mohan's thing was good too. I mean, it's really hard to leave people out because there was a lot of good stuff.
I even loved Scott Walter's presentation on the Corona document. I mean, I took a bunch of notes on his because I think there's some answers in there for how the Templars travel from Europe to the Americas is linked by the Azores, right? So we talked for a while about some of the stuff that we've been finding in the Azores that seemed to be are absolutely Templar connections, and him and Tim both are like, yeah, the Azores is an important place. They would have definitely known about it, and they didn't really go much further past that. Not sure if it's just because they don't know or if it's because they're being, you know, kind of tight-lipped about it or what, but regardless, his was great. There was some fire erupted in Mark Young's presentation. He had so losing control of the past was the title of his presentation, and you know, he talks about the detractors, the Flint Dibble, the other guys that have been shitting all over the Comet Research Group, and you know, he was pretty stern, and some gentleman in the audience piped up and was being pretty combative, and it was, you know, a healthy-ish debate, but he was basically like, you're accusing all these guys of doing the same thing that they're accusing you of and whatever. And it was kind of was this heated debate, which was good, like I said, but his presentation was really good. It put the whole Younger Dryas impact hypothesis into more of a historical perspective. And then talked about some new evidence that was found. And that was a great one too, but that's pretty much all the ones that I saw. I think we, you know, covered everything. You know, Hugh Newman's was awesome with Karahan Tepe, and Robert Schock was similar to last year, but he did bring some new things in, and of course Randall can't go wrong with Mega Flood. So
did you see Chris Cottrell's stuff at all? I mean, he's got an, we're gonna have him on the show. He's I missed awesome. His presentation too.
Yeah, Chris is awesome. We have little discussions on the Discord server, Cosmic Summit Discord server, every so often. He's actually Azorian. That's where his mother, I believe, is from.
Right,
kind of a link there that we have explored.
Yeah. The Mark Young, I just happened to go into his presentation at the time when he was talking about how the scientists like basically left out this massive, this massive data about like they basically like hit all this data that changes the whole hypothesis about the comet.
They omitted a gap. So there was a gap between 151 and 155 centimeter depth where the black mat would have existed if they didn't take this data point out at 153. And he got with a guy that was a part of the original team of that study, and he showed him one of the early manuscripts that shows at 153 a clear platinum spike, and they took it out before publishing as a takedown of the YDIH. So it's like, this is fucking unacceptable. These people should be, I mean, if you could disbar a professor, that would be grounds for it for sure.
Yeah.
A researcher, whatever.
It's interesting to see the scientific fraud, even from like the more scientific communities about comet research and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just unbelievable. It's like they're just doing whatever they can to hold the narrative.
Yeah.
Seems to be the case.
Begs the question, like, why are they trying so hard to cover this up?
Yeah.
Is it really just ego? Is it really just?
Yeah, doesn't seem like it. Would you put your job on the line to cover up like an impact hypothesis? I mean, it just seems crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Integrity is something that I've looked towards my entire career, and in my company, Integrity, we hold it very high to the point where we will not allow the truth to be hidden because of out of fear that we'll get in trouble for like a quality incident or something. No, you bring that stuff up. You don't lie about it. And when you do, you are rewarded. And maybe that's just not a present paradigm in academia right now. It's unfortunate, but I wish it was.
There you have it. Cosmic Summit 2025. I think it's just cosmicsummit.com, right? If people want to keep an eye on that and see.
Cosmicsummit.com, yeah.
People want to keep an eye on that, see if they want to go next year. And, of course, contact@thecabin.com if you want to get into something sooner than that. We got a bunch of cool stuff coming up over the next 8 or 9 months. I think we'll leave it at that. Hey, thanks, Nick. We appreciate you coming on and helping us out with this recap. I did notice you're taking a ton of notes the whole time. I mean, I was busy hustling. We had meetings during some of the good ones, right? Some of the best presentations we were stuck in meetings for, but this is what happened when you only see each other a few times a year. And luckily we have the live streams to check out, which people can use. What was the code? Three cams.
Yeah.
Three cams, not sex stuff, but check that out.
Number three or the word?
Number three, CAMS capitalized, I think.
And you can get that for $50. You can have, you know, kind of the same experience, not quite, but it'll still be cool, and you can sort of draw it out and don't do it at your own schedule instead of cramming it all in at once. America.ca/support. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Toodles. We'll be right back.
I'm